Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's never really a secret what the Federal Reserve's going to do, and they want it that way, because you can't have Wall Street doing anything rash. So by the time the Fed announced its interest rate cut this afternoon, the markets were primed, but that doesn't mean they were happy about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Tuesday today, the 11th of December, and it is great to have you here. If you want to sound hip when you talk about this at your office holiday party, what you should say is that Wall Street had already priced the rate cut in. That is, traders spent the past couple of days buying and selling on the assumption the Fed would cut rates. And that did indeed happen today. Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues at the Federal Open Market Committee cut short-term interest rates a quarter of a point. Problem is, Wall Street and pretty much everybody else was banking on a half a point cut. Diane Swonks, the chief economist at Mesirow Financial.
It puts the Fed in a position of having to do it again in January and still not being able to sort of walk with the conviction that they have reestablished confidence in financial markets. It keeps the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street.
It's always a good idea to read the statement the Fed puts out after it meets. About the only ray of sunshine today for analysts worried about the credit crunch was that the Fed did indeed leave the door open to the idea of more cuts when it meets at the end of January. Just about any stock that's sensitive to interest rate changes took a drubbing today. That would include the big Wall Street banks because they have been hit hardest by the liquidity squeeze. They've also been among the most creative in trying to find a way out. A key part of their plan up till now was a super fund of sorts to shore up confidence in what are called structured investment vehicles. SIVs are those ridiculously complicated devices Wall Street created to sell off subprime loans and the like. Anyway, that super fund idea never really caught on. Banks weren't necessarily wild about throwing good money after bad. And today, no less an authority than Warren Buffett put what is probably the last nail in the super SIV coffin. From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
The idea behind the bailout fund was to buy assets like mortgage-backed securities from the SIVs or SIVs. It was supposed to prevent a sell-off that could cripple the markets. But today, Warren Buffett told CNBC the Superfund's involvement won't make those assets any more attractive.
You can't turn a financial toad into a prince by kissing it or by securitizing it or by transferring its ownership to somebody else. If there's problems with an instrument, there's problems with an instrument.
The market seems to agree. Many of the banks the Superfund was intended to help are taking matters into their own hands. HSBC and Germany's WestLB are just two banks that have restructured their own SIVs. One of the worst off, Citigroup, has reportedly managed to sell $15 billion in SIV assets. Bert Ely is a banking consultant in Alexandria, Virginia.
More and more banks look closely at the super SIV idea. They reach a conclusion that they're better off not participating.
So is the super SIV dead in the water? Mike Ehrlich teaches finance at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. He says supporters of a bailout fund may still raise the money, but in the end, there may not be many troubled assets left to buy.
Most of the assets that are in the SIVs are relatively short-term assets. They're assets with probably an average life of 2 or 3 years.
The pressure is not off yet. Moody's Investors Service has warned it may lower its credit ratings for more than $100 billion in SIVs. Those cuts could make it harder for the SIVs to raise money and could increase the pressure on them to sell their assets. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
It was a rough day on Wall Street, and of course, more on that later. But the New York Stock Exchange is always looking for new business. Today, the big board opened an office in Beijing to tap into the booming Chinese equity market. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was on hand for the ceremony. He's in China for the next round of economic talks there. Meanwhile, today brought another sign of potential overheating in that economy. Marketplace's Scott Tong has more now from Shanghai.
6.9%. That's China's inflation rate, the highest in 11 years. Blame oil prices. Blame a shortage of pork. And blame cash. Economist Stephen Green at Standard Chartered Bank says too much cash is sloshing around in China, pushing up prices.
The fundamental issue is this economy is too liquid. That needs to change. And one of the only ways that can change is on the exchange rate.
I.e., appreciate the RMB more quickly against the dollar. That's Hank Paulson's argument, that this helps China and it makes U.S. exporters more competitive. The economics are debatable. But politically, independent economist Andy Shade doubts Chinese leaders will risk a big policy change. He says it's a fragile economy running awfully fast now. So slow is the word on currency reform.
In Japan, it took 10 years. I doubt it would take less in China. So we're lucky if China has a convertible currency by 2015.
China is moving on other fronts. Today, the two sides signed a product safety deal on Chinese food and drug exports. And Beijing may grant more market access to Western investment banks and stock funds. Still, forecaster William Hess at Global Insight doubts China will give away the store to a lame duck U.S. administration.
Given the uncertainty in the political climate in Washington, to give something to Paulson now may not carry the same weight as it would later.
Paulson will take something home. China's head of product quality gave Paulson a Christmas present, a perfectly safe, made-in-China toy dog. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Back in this country, hundreds of flights have been canceled or delayed today. Airports are closed across the Midwest because of that ice storm they're having. There's not much you can do when the weather doesn't cooperate, but sometimes delays are just because there are too many planes trying to fly to too many places. Next week, the federal government's expected to announce a plan that might help some. It wants to limit the number of flights in and out of New York's Kennedy Airport, one of the country's busiest. The FAA is thinking about auctioning off landing slots. Also next week, the airline industry is headed to court. It's trying to block a passenger bill of rights that's supposed to go into effect after the new year. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has that story.
To anyone who's been stuck on a runway for hours, the demands don't seem unreasonable. The new Bill of Rights would apply to any plane leaving a New York airport more than 3 hours late. Airlines would have to provide food, water, electricity, and waste removal, or face a fine of $1,000 a passenger. But the Air Transport Association, which represents airlines in the U.S., says air travel is a federal issue where states have no jurisdiction.
It's absurd. The ATA is the bully pulpit for the airlines.
Kate Hannay is executive director of the Consumer Group Coalition for an Airline Passengers Bill of Rights.
Unless we take a stand as passengers and allow the states to have rights, we don't have any. There's no right for the passengers to sue an airline. There's no real rights for a passenger in the event of any on-ground delay.
That may be true, but airline analyst Roger King says giving passengers more rights or punishing airlines for delays doesn't address the real problem.
Too many flights are scheduled for the capacity of the airports at certain times a day. And then when you compound that with a weather situation, and it doesn't have to be weather in your, you know, at the airport, it could be weather 1,000 miles away that's blocking the ability of a flight to take off. It's a very complicated, complex system.
The feds want to make that system simpler by limiting air traffic at JFK. Analyst King says cutting back flights could help airlines because they could charge more. The ATA wouldn't comment on what it calls a legal issue. First hearing in the case is next Tuesday. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
There was some new math on Wall Street today. A quarter percentage point equal to 300-point drop on the Dow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've all got a lot going on this time of year, making holiday plans and trying to figure out what to buy for which relative. It's also when most of us give in a different way as we make our annual contributions to our favorite causes. We're going to spend some time this week on philanthropy, some of the trends and newish developments. Also, what you really get when you give.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
We'll start today with that giving and how charities are making it easier than ever to donate. You can drop a dollar at the checkout stand or round up your online purchase to the nearest buck and donate the difference. It sounds small, but those nickels and dimes add up in the end. It's a concept philanthropy consultant Lucy Bernholtz calls embedded giving.
Think about the products that exist just to raise money for charity. So all of Newman's own products and the product Red Line, there's that kind. That's kind of the product philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
The other kind of embedded giving is when you have an opportunity to make some change with your change. So you bring your own grocery bag, donate your nickel to a nonprofit at the grocery store. That's that kind. And then the third kind is when you're redirecting other people's money. And this is the kind that's growing fastest. You think about the working assets telephone model, where if you use that service, some of your money goes to charity at the end of the year. Or there's an increasing number of search engines that allow you to do your regular searching on the internet, and some of the advertising revenue will go to a good cause.
Sounds like a pretty disparate revenue stream for charity writ large. Is there any way to account sort of for how much money is involved here?
Well, that's the big question, Kai. We've got $300 billion a year in charitable giving in the U.S., and this kind of giving seems to be everywhere. You can go out in your average day, and you'll probably have four or five opportunities to do some giving this way, but nobody seems to be counting it.
If it's not getting counted, then how do we know that it's all going to the purpose for which it was intended? I'm not worried about my nickel at the grocery store so much, but, you know, I mean, this money does add up over time.
Well, I'll tell you what my concern is. The fastest growing part of this, as far as I can tell, are, like I mentioned, the online search engines where you can do your regular business and some of your money will be redirected to what the sites clearly mark as a good cause. Now, here's the thing. I can define my shoe budget as a good cause,
right,
just as you can define funding for juvenile diabetes as a good cause. And on some of those websites, there's no distinction made. Now, they're very upfront about that, but I'm not so sure too many of us pay that much attention to the fine print when we're doing our searching. And if you think you're giving this money to charity, and should you decide at the end of the year you'd like to try to account for your own contributions, you're not going to be able to.
Yeah, which has tax implications, right?
That's right. We're losing all of this as part of what we're counting in the taxable, the non-taxable charitable giving. The other big question that I would raise is this going to cause donor fatigue? If I'm out there doing my normal shopping and I give a nickel at the coffee store and a dollar at the drugstore and a dollar outside the grocery store, when I sit down in the evening and look at all that direct mail I've got from nonprofits, I might just feel like, hey, wait a minute, I did my giving already.
All right, so let me ask you this at the end of the day then. Do you not give the buck for breast cancer research a checkout, and do you not click on the thing on the web?
Well, I don't use the embedded giving search engines. Just like you, I think the internet just is a little too – takes too much of my work to figure out if all of those are legit. When I'm face-to-face with a cashier at the Safeway and she asks me to give to breast cancer research – sometimes I give and sometimes I don't.
Yeah, me too, actually. Lucy Bernholtz is the president of Blueprint Research and Design. It's a consulting firm for philanthropic institutions, individuals too. Lucy, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Whether it's the local Safeway store or some web-based e-tailer that are collecting your embedded donations, part of what's going on there is corporate America trying to earn some brownie points, cashing in on the customer's desire to do good. That's a notion that extends beyond pure philanthropy, of course. I'm sure you've seen ads about what this company or that is doing for the environment or for the local community. Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports the idea of corporate responsibility has become an industry unto itself.
Rob Kaplan is Brown-Forman's senior analyst for corporate responsibility. Brown-Forman owns Jack Daniel's Whiskey and 36 other brands. Its corporate responsibility office is quite new, just 2 years old. Like many people in his profession, Kaplan is new, too. This is his first job since he graduated from business school in May.
Corporate responsibility, to me, is about how we conduct our business and really connecting these greater social values to our bottom line.
Kaplan is faced with a particular challenge, how to make a purveyor of sinful booze look like a paragon of civic virtue.
So our products are made from corn, for example, in Jack Daniel's. So what are the agricultural impacts of that? Then your production process and the pollution or the water use. Then you move on to, you know, distribution and marketing. How can we be responsible in our marketing with alcohol?
Companies of all sizes and in all sectors are embracing corporate responsibility, and they're defining it in different ways. It's spawned an entire new consulting industry. And now advertising, marketing, and PR firms are telling their clients they can sell more products through corporate responsibility campaigns. Richard Edelman runs one of the largest PR firms in the country.
Increasingly, we're trying to find a larger purpose for corporate campaigns. So eco-imagination for GE, for example, for the first time, a major corporation was saying it's smart business to be green. So the products are going to have to connect beyond a functional benefit, that they're going to have some kind of bigger halo, something that they're involved in.
Cheerleaders for the corporate responsibility movement say it could transform American business. But Steve Rocklin of Accountability North America says companies co-opt the concept of corporate responsibility to boost their public images. He's been watching corporations try to clean up their acts for more than 10 years.
It's the height of hypocrisy, for example, for a company to take out an advertisement that is 10 times greater than the budget it is putting into a particular issue, cause, or effort. And so we start to see that type of thing happen too often.
Rocklin worries that consumers will see corporate responsibility as just another public relations gimmick. He says if the concept is discredited, companies won't even attempt to behave ethically or sensitively. Rob Kaplan at Brown-Forman says he's finding it a hard sell, even in his own company.
So, you know, I'm in the corporate responsibility department, you know, banging on doors and trying to get people to listen to me. Really, the best way to make change is by incorporating it into a mainstream or traditional job function.
It's happening slowly, or seems to be. American companies are making earnest statements about corporate responsibility. And Kaplan says many of his B-school buddies got jobs in the field. Hopefully, their enthusiasm will rub off on their employers. Then perhaps American business really will change from the inside. I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Tomorrow in our philanthropy series, how giving really does make you richer. Coming up, are you wondering what to get Grandma for Christmas? Well, try a racing game.
Some of the women there were telling me that they liked it because they haven't driven in, you know, 20 years.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials plunged 294 points today, 2.1% to close at 13,432. The Nasdaq crumbled 66 points, 2.4% to 26.52. The S&P 500 slumped 38 points. That's 2.5% to 1477 at the close. Washington Mutual dove more than 12% today. Freddie Mac was right behind, sinking more than 10%. Adding to the banking carnage, Bank of America and Citigroup both skidded off track more than 4% today. Starbucks got a splash of decaf after Goldman Sachs downgraded the world's largest coffee chain from buy to neutral. That sent shares down 3.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the benchmark 10-year T fell to 3.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529. And the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the trade balance report for October. The Treasury Department reports on the federal budget for November. And who do you call if you've got a complaint about your bank? A House committee addresses that issue at a hearing on the Financial Consumer Hotline Act of 2007. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I don't know about you, but the Hollywood writers' strike is finally starting to hit home at my house. I went to my TiVo last night to catch the most recent episode of Brothers and Sisters. came up empty, just that sad bonk bonk sound. Trivial, I know, but symptomatic of some larger issues, really. NBC has begun giving money back to its advertisers because they're not getting the audiences they paid so richly for. Also, television critics have canceled their winter get-together. They meet to check out the network's new mid-season offerings every January. But now there's not much new to look at, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Last summer, marketers paid about $9 billion in advance for primetime TV advertising. The networks guarantee a certain audience for those commercials. If viewers don't tune in, the networks must make good on it. That's what's happening at NBC. It started giving advertisers back millions of dollars in refunds.
It wouldn't surprise me if other broadcast networks follow what NBC's doing in the upcoming months.
That's Brad Adgate with Horizon Media, which buys advertising time for clients. He thinks ratings will drop at all the networks as they air more reruns and reality shows. The lack of fresh material is one reason the networks pulled out of the Television Critics Association's Winter Press Tour. The January event is where TV executives show off their new sitcoms and dramas. Dave Walker is president of the association.
January is when the networks were really going to start showing the effects of the strike.
That means no new shows to promote and lots of tough questions for TV executives to answer. Again, Dave Walker.
100-plus writers from around the country and Canada will not go to L.A. preparing to put a human face on the impact of the strike in Los Angeles.
Who gets the better PR, the suits or the writers? That doesn't really matter to advertisers. Horizon Media's Brad Adgate says marketers are already finding other ways to reach consumers.
And I think that's one of the great ironies of this whole strike or this whole impasse is that it's about digital media, and digital media could be the one that benefits the most.
He expects advertisers will begin shifting more ad dollars to the Internet. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
How many times today did you sit down at your computer and look something up online? For me, it was probably a couple of dozen. But overall, every month, 8 billion searches are done on the Internet. Each one of them leaves a tiny trail of digital breadcrumbs behind who you are, what you're looking for. Now one search company is changing that and hoping it gives them a competitive edge. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains.
The search engine Ask.com today introduced a feature that allows you to leave no trace of your searches. Most of the big guns in the business keep search information on file for at least a year to tailor the ads you see. Greg Jarbo is with the Search Engine Marketing Professionals Organization. He says people are starting to wonder.
Do you want somebody being able to get at somebody's files and discover what you've been looking at?
A recent incident involving Facebook caused a brouhaha after a member's surprise Christmas purchase was announced to everyone in his network, including his wife. Paul Stevens of the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse says that's made people more aware of the power we've been giving up online.
As people see these sorts of things happening, they do get a greater awareness and are more likely to demand or look for sites that are going to respect their privacy.
Which is what Ask.com is banking on. It's got only 5% of the online search market. Google's got 65%. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Nintendo has managed to pull off that rarest of retail doubleheaders. Its Wii game console was among the hot gifts last Christmas. This year, if possible, it's even hotter. So if you're in the market for one, good luck to you. And you're going to need it, because you might have to fight your grandma to get one. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Get out your date books. The place to be tomorrow night is in Erickson Retirement Home outside Chicago.
Welcome to Erickson Sports' first annual Wii Bowling Championship.
Four teams, 16 people, no one is under 65. Nintendo's game console, the Wii, is their battleground.
Bowling for the Sedgbrook Alley Cats, we have Otto Six-Pack Ream, Ginger, Ginger Snap Cox, Flora, Flora Dora Dearbach.
Flora Floradora Dearbuck is the head of the entertainment committee at the Erickson home. She says there's almost always a line of people waiting to use the Wii, and residents are hot to buy more.
And I know they haunt the stores because they're difficult to find, and they get an ad in the paper saying somebody has them, and they go out there and they try to get it, and they're gone.
That kind of following is exactly what Nintendo had in mind when it started giving free consoles to senior centers recently. a quarter of all gamers are over 50, up from around 10% in 1999. And seniors buy 25% of game consoles, although some may be for their grandkids. Serious gamers have an explanation for this.
Well, it's a fad. It's like a Furby.
Crispin Boyer, an editor at Electronic Gaming Monthly, says he was skeptical until he took a bunch of games to a senior center in California. Wii Ping Pong was popular, and so was racing.
And some of the women there were telling me that they liked it because they haven't driven in, you know, 20 years. So it's fun to get back behind the wheel, even if it's like a virtual driving experience.
These programs are called casual games. They're the fastest growing segment of the $30 billion video game market. But some senior gamers need training. So with those consoles, Nintendo sends experts.
So bring it up to your face and hold the trigger button.
Hold the trigger button. Which is the trigger button?
The trigger button's back here. I'll show you one more time.
Noah Kircher-Allen teaches seniors to bowl on the Wii. Today he's at the Pasadena Senior Center in Southern California. Among his students is Marcia Berger. She says she appreciates the attention from the game industry, but she wishes companies would be more realistic when they market to people like her.
Sometimes when I see the Viagra commercials, and my husband takes Viagra, so we love it. You don't see somebody my husband's age, you see somebody in his 40s. It's like my husband's 67. Where are those guys?
Members of the Pasadena Center plan to start a virtual bowling league next month. Marcia thinks that they should make an event of it with snacks and...
You know, a little martini. Well, if I get them just a little tipsy, maybe I can beat them.
I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to get us back to the macroeconomic news we started with today. A glimpse backwards can often tell us what's coming, and the look in the rearview mirror doesn't promise good things for the advertising sector. According to TNS Media today, ad spending barely budged during the first 9 months of the year, up just 0.2% to $108 billion. Concerns about the economy and consumer spending contributed to the softness. A slight bump in the third quarter did help counter declines earlier in the year, but TNS cautioned not to count on that as a turnaround. One analyst said there might still be a few more boogeymen out there. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow skidded down 294 points after the Fed rate cut announcement. That's 0.2%. The Nasdaq shook off 66 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 drooped 38 points, 2.5% there. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, charitable giving as a business.
My whole staff became very heavily invested because it was ours versus someone else's plan that we then had to sell to people and say, this is the next thing we ought to be doing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.